Welcome to Rumors, Money, and Movies. As always, I'm your host, James Bass Stone. It's been a bit of a layoff, it's been a bit of a break, and I apologize for that. I'm going to explain why. I hope everyone's doing well. We have a good interview coming up with George Siegel, who's a documentary filmmaker. I'm really glad I came across him. It's going to be a really interesting interview, and I think everyone's going to enjoy it. As always, you can follow us at Twitter, RMM_901. You can follow us at Letterboxd, at JABNYRIC. The Letterboxd is popping off. It's fantastic. So I put it on pause and I got really busy. As if many of you know, I was on the Auslan Festival in Peekskill with Scarlett Antonia. If you haven't listened to that episode, please do. Tremendous woman, tremendous history of her life, and a lot of really tremendous name drops and people you've known about and heard of. I thought it was one of the best interviews we've ever done. So I was in that in September. Following that, I was in on a play production of The Great Gatsby in Bartow Pell Mansion in Pelham Bay, Bronx, New York. I was on that for a week and a half, so I was really busy. I also have another job that I work from. I have a job that I work on the side to make money outside of film and entertainment. I've also been working with that professional wrestling company, ECPW. You can check out their YouTube videos and their shows on YouTube. My episodes are not out yet, but very shortly my episodes will be out, the episodes that I actually filmed for them. And then there might be a little bit of a gap after this episode because I actually have two feature film jobs coming up, one in Southern New Jersey and one in upstate New York. So it's going to be a really busy time for me. So I'm not going to probably be able to get a podcast done, but I do have another interview that I believe we'll be able to have very shortly and some of the things I'm working on to continue this podcast. I definitely don't want to quit the podcast. It's just going to become a little bit more, because I'm not quitting until we get to 100, but it's going to become less regular, especially because I'm very busy. I'm working de facto full time, and then I have my film stuff on top of that, and then I have other things that I got to do. So it's a lot of stuff right now, but I do want to commit to that format. And so with that format comes the box office. So since the last time we talked, a lot has happened in the box office. Barbie, Oppenheimer, that has passed now, as we talked about. If you want more on that, go listen to our last podcast. Since then, we had Gran Turismo, which basically tied Barbie at the box office the last week of August. And the first week of September, which is Labor Day, we had Equalizer 3 with Denzel Washington, finished number one with $34 million. The total weekend was $89 million. That was right in line with the predictions and what the franchise has done in the past. Nun 2, which was a two-pack of ass, I heard, finished number one three straight weekends. That was mainly because a bunch of other films around it bombed. But the weekend of September 8th, September 15th, and September 22nd, Nun 2 won with $32 million, $14 million, and $8 million. Really low weekends, though. September 20th, only had $1 total at the box office, which was second lowest, basically the lowest, because the other one was like 51.86. It was like a $100,000 difference between the two weekends. So not very good. During that three-week stretch, we had films like Expendables, Bomb, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3, completely bomb. So we've had films that weren't doing very well. We then went to Paw Patrol, which hit with $22 million, which was actually a good result. $85 million total for the box office that weekend. Then Exorcist Believer with $26 million, $72 million total. Mediocre opens, mediocre runs. Honestly, the best performing films were films that a lot of people didn't even know about or they weren't even expecting, like The Blind, which was, again, one of those we always talk about. The religious films that come up out of nowhere. The Blind was another religious film that's doing really, really well at the box office. Out big budgeted Hollywood films that already has $14 million at the box office, which is a really good result for that. Saw 10, which never finished number one at the box office, but has really good reviews. I actually want to see it because it's supposedly a really good film. It has $42 million domestically, $67 million globally. So it's a good result for that film. It's doing well. And Dumb Money has done pretty well, which was about the GameStop's AMC Apes, has $13 million domestically, which again is kind of not a great number. I know that, but realistically speaking, what is the ability for a film like this to make money? It is pretty much as good as it gets at this point for a film like this. But again, way more misses than hits. Expendables 4 completely bombed. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3 completely bombed. Haunting in Venice, which is the Kevin Branagh murder mystery adaptations, completely bombed. The Creator, which is a very interesting film if you want to learn about some things going on in Hollywood and special effects. The Creator is really interesting, but that is going to lose money. I mean, it only made $80 million globally, and I heard it wasn't very good. So again, just a lot of just really mediocre and mid films that were being released in this time. And I say to my people, say, why is Hollywood not making money? And I say to people, because the product's terrible. The product is atrocious, right? If you're not familiar with Letterboxd, this is kind of like where all the real film people and also casual film people go to read, watch, and review films. And I say to people, you know, a 3.5 or above is a pretty good score on Letterboxd. Anything all below a 3 is horrendous because you're gonna get some bullshit 5-star reviews on Letterboxd. Excuse my French, but there's some really bad movies that have like 4.4, and I don't know how. I've seen them, but I'll just like go through some of them, right? A Haunting in Venice had 3.1 stars. Okay, no one really got out of their seats for that one. Expendables 4, 1.9 stars. Oh, geez. Horrendous. Horrific. Again, 1.9 stars out of 5. Like, this is not a good result. Nun 2, which again did very well at the box office, 2.3 stars out of 5. Exorcist Believer, 2.2 stars out of 5. These are not good results for films that are trying to make money. So people say, well, why are we not making money? It's because the movies that you're releasing are no one asked for them. No one asked for name. If you know somebody who knows somebody who wanted to watch Expendables 4, God bless. If you know somebody who was interested in my Big Fat Greek Rating 3, God bless. Nun 2, Exorcist 4, Saw 10. You know, these movies, most people don't care about the Saw franchise anymore or the Exorcist franchise anymore or any of the. I mean, I hope you don't need me to tell you this, but like, then people were like, oh, why are we not making money? That's the first thing. Second thing is, they're not being asked for, but then they're not good. They're not good quality. And then you're just releasing like three of them at once. You know, nothing can break out. Nothing can get known. Nothing can get a measure of in the overall conversation of the world because none of these films are breaking out or and they have nothing of importance to say. They're not significant. They don't matter. Right? They're not of anything of significance. Nun 2 doesn't have anything significant or important to say. Exorcist 7 doesn't have anything important or significant to say. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3 doesn't have anything of importance or significance to say. Now, these movies probably will do pretty well on Peacock or Netflix or wherever they end up going, and they'll do pretty well. But that doesn't mean that they're good movies. So how do you fix that? To me, it's like if you're going to lose money, or you're not going to make money on a shit film, you might as well try to make money or do something with a good film. And what I think the problem is that for someone like myself, there's no reason why I need to see Nun 2 or Exorcist 4. And I don't feel existential about it because I still have the 60s. I need to go through the 70s. I need to go through the 80s. I need to go through the 90s and the 2000s. I need to go through. But I have so many films to still watch. And I am still watching a lot of films, so it doesn't affect me. But the reason why the greats and the directors and the people who know about film are telling you how bad it is because they were born in 1983. They saw everything. And now what they're watching, it's a two-pack of ass. And that's why they tell you that film is dying because they're, you know, for people like me or maybe other people, we all have all these old films that we can still watch. Oh my God, I haven't seen this movie from 1979. Well, of course, you know, if you were born in 1970, you've seen it already, right? That's the problem, is that none of the new stuff is good. So you're just adding bad shit on top of the good stuff. But the good stuff's still there, but you'd think you'd be building more and more. And the strike is hurting, yes, because you could say, well, the strike, you know, you'd have late night television and you'd be able to podcast and talk about, okay, what, $3, $4 million a movie, maybe? Seriously, how much would that have moved everything? Going to change the overall issue or the overall problem. Well, that last weekend was Taylor Swift the Eras Tour. Broke a record for single weekend for a concert film, already has the record for the highest grossing concert film of all time in one weekend. Was the second highest October window weekend of all time by a movie. $92 million. So we competed right up there with Joker, which had $96 million. A tremendous result yet again, and shows really the true staying power of Taylor Swift. I gotta give the devil, you know, I gotta give respect where respect is earned. This woman went on one of the biggest tours ever, went on the biggest tour of 2023, sold out stadiums upon stadiums multiple times. Now she has the second highest opening for a film ever in the month of October at $92 million. For a film that's basically, I heard, is just like a concert from her. It's not like a, there's no like story or like backstage footage or anything. It's just like she walks up, she sings her 12 song and her set list, and she leaves. Granted, I don't like Taylor Swift. I think her music's shit, to be honest with you. I'm just going to put it out there. I don't like her. You can like her. Fantastic. I feel good for you. And all the Swifty stuff is weird and doesn't make any sense to me. Why people worship a human being that eats like they do, poops like they do, walks like they do. It's ridiculous. But here we are. This is our world that we live in. And that's really a thing I was thinking about, you know, back in the day. You had Dean Martin. You had Sinatra. You had guys like that that would go in and act, right? That would make money as a performer. And they'd be like an all-purpose entertainer, go into acting. Make money, get paid, sign contracts. I mean, if you made a musical, seriously, if you made a musical that people know about, like if you made a remake with Singing in the Rain, starring Taylor Swift, I mean, that's going to open with like $150 million. Am I wrong for like, you got to pay her like $50 million or something. And if you're Taylor, why wouldn't you do that? To me, this is the type of creative stuff that I've been begging people to come up with, because, you know, she's obviously the biggest draw that we've seen in a very long time. People say, well, she's been in movies before. And that is true. Valentine's Day, a small part, The Lorax, The Giver, Cats. So, okay, first of all, those four movies are not indicative of anything. Valentine's Day, she had a small role. Lorax, she was an added value. That movie also made a lot of money. The Giver, which I went to go see in theaters, I think she had to have like a 2-minute role in that, if I remember correctly. She did not have a big role in that. Cats was dog, so I'm not even going to include that. And then Amsterdam, like I said, who she must have been in it for like 4 minutes, which completely bombed. But like, you know, do we singing in the, I mean, I hope they don't do a remake of anything, but I'm just saying, like, that's what you got to be saying to yourself. That's my pitch. Just get Taylor Swift to do some movies for you. Maybe she'd save it. And we have an interview coming up with George Segal. I hope everyone really enjoys it. See you after the break. All right, so now here's the time for our interview, guys. We got George Segal. But I'm just going to call him Segal, even though he said call me Segal. For the rest of the interview, thanks so much, George, for coming on. It's a pleasure having you.
What do they say? Just don't call me late for dinner. Call me anything you want. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and George looks exactly like Eric Clapton. So
I don't know what he looks like. It's either a nice compliment or one hell of an insult, but I'll go with either one. It's all good.
Well, I mean, it's Eric Clapton, so I guess it's pretty damn good.
That's true. He's doing a lot better than I am. So,
well, before we get into start, I kind of set up the interview before for everybody, but how you just want to introduce yourself, who you are, what do you do?
Well, I do a lot of things. My current iteration of life. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I've produced a couple of documentaries that have done pretty well. I used to be a television newscaster, weatherman, sportscaster, game show host, all that kind of stuff in front of the camera. And then I also recently started a podcast called Homeowners Be Aware. And it's about, you know, all the stupid things we do as homeowners, the decisions we make without any knowledge. And I'm trying to show people that there's a way you can do that to minimize a lot of the grief along the way. So that's the other thing I do in my spare time.
Yeah. So we'll get into some of that. But before that, I always ask everyone who joins the podcast one very important question. Considering you are a documentary filmmaker, this might be somewhat easy for you to answer, but I always ask everyone, since this is a film podcast, what's your favorite film and what's your relationship to film? Let's get into those.
Well, I have a couple of favorites. My all-time favorite is kind of sappy, is On Golden Pond. That was with Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn, and Jane Fonda was in it. I also really, one of my favorites is Ordinary People, which is a movie that I could watch a million times. And then Good Will Hunting is another movie that I just thought was fantastic. There's a lot of movies that I love, but those are three that really stand out. My relation to filmmaking and to being in film, I grew up in Los Angeles for a lot of my life. And so you're kind of around that industry. And I was always fascinated by it. Not so much making features, but what I like about documentaries is it's a chance to tell a story. I'm not as big on the art documentary film, like the Plight of the Penguins or, you know, Saving the Whales. Although I think that's important. I like films that people can actually watch and then do something about, that they would see a difference themselves. You know, if I stop driving a gas car tomorrow, the Penguins still might not make it. But if I do something based on the films that I've made so far, it could make a difference in my life. And those are the kind of films I like to make.
Yeah, you did say you brought up that you live in LA. I saw that you're an alumni of UCLA in political science. How does someone who did that get into filmmaking?
Well, I realized I wasn't smart enough to be a lawyer. That's why I was a political science major. I thought I wanted to go to law school. I still kind of regret that to this day, that I would have loved to have done that. And then I hadn't really thought of filmmaking when I was in college. I was more into being in television. I wanted to be, you know, famous on television and have a career that way. But then when you find out all the BS that you have to deal with on that end of the business, that has more to do with things beyond your control, I wanted to have to try to have a little more control of my own destiny. I know a lot of people in film will say, but you don't always control your destiny there either. You still need other things to go right. But I just like that better. I like being behind the scenes more than I like being on camera.
And so where did you work in television? How did that career progress? Where did you work? Did you work local news stations? What did you do?
Yeah, I mean, I worked all over the place. When I got out of school, I got a job in Bakersfield, California. Then I moved to Fresno. Then I moved to San Francisco. Then I moved to LA. Then I moved to Seattle. Then I moved to Detroit. Then I moved to San Antonio, Texas. And then I said, all right, I think I want to do something else. And I started my own production company.
You were a nationwide traveler at that point.
Yeah, and I liked all the places. I lived some great places. I mean, you know, people laugh sometimes when they hear Detroit. I loved living in Detroit. I mean, it's cold in the winter, but there's great people there. The change of seasons can be really fun to be part of. There's beautiful places in Michigan, Seattle in Washington, the beautiful part of the country. San Francisco, I mean, used to be nicer than it is today, but I was fortunate enough to live some really cool places. And that's something I enjoyed.
And what's you mentioned your production company. How are you talking to us about that?
Well, when I got out of the television news business, I started a production company where I was making marketing videos and commercials and, you know, hustling for those kind of jobs. I tried creating a couple TV shows. That's really tough if you're independent, small person out there. And that was before documentaries really blew up. And then I decided to try my hand in that and come up with a couple subjects that I was passionate about and see if I could have any make any difference with documentary films. And so far it's been pretty good. And I'm really proud of the two films that I've made.
Yes, you have the two films that you've made. How about you talk to us about those? I have a lot of follow-up questions, but how about you just set the stage for those two films that you made?
The first one is called License to Parent. And, you know, I have five kids. If I was having a conversation with somebody, I would say nobody should have more than two. And they always get all fired up going, how dare you say that? And then they find out I have five and they know I was kind of pulling their leg. But I think people get the job of parent without any knowledge of what's involved with that job. They don't truly understand how difficult and how challenging that job is. And if they actually had to fill out an application to become a parent, I bet a lot of people would not be given children. And then there's a lot of people that are open-minded and evolve in that job that realize how important it is and do really well. But I think overall in this country, we don't have enough support for parents. We don't do enough to encourage and educate them. And I don't mean like an indoctrination kind of education. I mean more just helping them raise their kids in terms of advice, guidance, warning signs, things that could make a difference. And so that film was made about how we need more support for parents. The second film I made is called The Last House Standing, and that's about how we buy houses in places without truly understanding the risks. More people could probably tell you the safety features on their iPhone than they could tell you what makes their house safe. You just think, wow, if a builder built this, it must be good. And we see houses get wiped out and destroyed every year. If you just Google or YouTube for videos on poor construction, you see things that these are people's houses. This is what their life investment went into. And a lot of times they end up with crap. And I think we need to wake up and stop this. And that's what my film was about. It's saying, wake up and look, you need to be aware of this, because if we're waiting for our elected officials and our city officials to come in and save the day and change the codes and make things safer, that may not happen very quickly. That change takes a long time, but you can start demanding more right this minute. You can ask more questions when you're buying a house. You can hold a builder to a higher standard and say, I'm not going to take your garbage. Because the problem is when we buy somebody else's garbage, eventually somebody's got to pay for that. You know, if I buy a crappy house from you because you didn't put in a good air conditioning system and you didn't put in good appliances, and then 3 years from now I go to sell the house, they may want that fixed at that point. I may run into somebody more like me that goes, wait a second, this is garbage you're selling me. So I think we have to demand more. We need to know why our houses will survive disasters, what the builder thought about when they were building it that makes it a safe house, not just a pretty house. And, you know, I was able to get that on public television. It's on Tubi TV right now, if anybody wanted to watch it for free. And it's also on my website, thelasthousestanding.org. And it's an important film, I think, that will open people's eyes about just what a risk they're taking when they choose where they're living.
Yeah, so I'm going to get to that film in a second. I do want to tell a licensed parent, but it's a question that applies to both is, how do you approach covering these sensitive issues? Because a lot of the documentary focuses on some dark subjects.
You know, that's the challenge, because different filmmakers have different approaches. For me, from my years of experience in television news, I'm sensitive to what the person who I'm talking to might be saying. So, for example, in Licensed to Parent, we had to talk to a family who had their children taken away because they were drug addicts. And before we did the interview, I said, look, I really want you to understand, in this film, you're portrayed as a bad parent who was a drug addict because that's what happened to you. I want to make sure you're okay with that. Some filmmakers will just walk up to anybody and ask anything, get them to sign the release, and they're okay with it. I'm more thinking, okay, what's this? How's this going to affect your life if you do it?
Right.
And I just not wired to do it differently. And it's tough because you have to talk to people about sensitive things. I had to talk to a young man who thought about killing himself. And that's heartbreaking at any level you're doing an interview when somebody's life was so bad for them that they were willing to end their life. And it's tough to do those interviews. It's emotionally tough. And I'm sure it's tougher for them to be living with that. And then it's finding the people to be in the film overall and getting officials to talk to you. You know, people are somewhat leery of filmmakers, unless you're Michael Moore, that'll just go up and stick a microphone in anybody's face and have the budget to get away with that. For the little guy, it's harder to do that.
Right.
Because I don't just need to get you to be interviewed. I need to get you to sign a release allowing me to use that interview, or you could sue me. So it's challenging. And the more sensitive the subject, the more challenging it is.
How was that different from when you were in the news?
Well, the news, you don't have to get anybody's permission. You know, if the news is doing overweight people, they can go to the beach and just roll their camera. And if you're lying out there and you're 50 pounds overweight, you're on the news that night and they don't owe you anything. They're allowed to just shoot anything they want and do anything they want if it's on public property. Whereas with a documentary film, in order for somebody to broadcast your film, you need to go through an attorney and get the shots cleared. You need to get errors and omissions insurance. You need to insure it, because somebody ends up in your film that doesn't want to be, you could get sued. You know, if you're showing a couple at the movies and it turns out that was a man who wasn't with his wife, he ends up getting divorced, you outed him in the film, he's going to sue you. They don't sue TV news stations for that. That was just your bad luck for being at the movie with the wrong person. So there's a major difference in the two mediums. In a film, you can take clips of other films. It's called fair use. And if it advances your story, you can use those clips in your film. But you can't take innocent private citizens and put them in there without them agreeing to be in your film.
I don't think a lot of people know that.
Yeah, it's a totally different world. And what's scary is you have to have them sign a release. And some people want to change the terms of the release. I had one guy that said, I don't want to be interviewed unless I can see the film before it comes out. That's a really risky thing to do as a filmmaker. If you're interviewing somebody important for your film and they can look at it and then say they don't like it, so you can't use it. And we had that in my last film, The Last House Standing. We got in to see FEMA. And FEMA, the only way they would let us interview the FEMA director was to give them final cut on that interview. So I had to show them the film and they had to say, yes, it's good, or no, it's not. Now, I wasn't worried in this instance, because the only reason FEMA let us in is because of the message we were talking about. It wasn't criticizing them for their relief and how they do their job. They get criticized for that all the time. This was more about how they could be people can be proactive and help FEMA by being more prepared. So I didn't put anything in there that they wouldn't like. But what scared me with that film was Brock Long was the gentleman we interviewed. Great guy. I've interviewed him several times since then. But he left as FEMA director before the film came out. And you never know internally if that was a good thing or a bad thing. And I thought FEMA could say, nah, we don't want Brock on there representing FEMA. But apparently everything was okay and it wasn't a problem. But that's the only time I've ever done that, and I would never do that again.
What's that process like trying to solicit these interviews for these two documentaries? We'll get specifically into them, but just in general, so people who don't know a lot about film can kind of get the process.
You have to reach out to people and tell them what you're doing and give them enough of an idea that they're comfortable being interviewed for your project. It took us over a year to get into FEMA. There's a gentleman in the film, The Last House Standing, Hank Ovink, who we saw on 60 Minutes. And he was great on 60 Minutes. I said, I got to get that guy for the film. That took a year and a half to get him because he's so busy. And even when we did get him, they said, I live in Tampa, Florida. They said, yeah, he's going to be at a seminar in Clearwater on such and such a date. And we can try to put you in to talk to him at the end of the day. And I said, look, that's not going to work because he's so busy. The end of the day is going to turn into I can't do it. I go, can you get him for me at the beginning of his day? And so they scheduled us before his day got busy and we were able to interview him. There was somebody there looking at their watch the whole time because they had to whisk him to something else. But he was great. He was a superstar. But it took a lot of work to get him. A lot of people wouldn't talk to us. I tried to reach out to a lot of politicians. No politician would talk to us. And then as far as storm victims, you have to be sensitive to that. When somebody just lost their house, I just can't go up and say, tell me what you, how do you feel? You know, you have to be somewhat guarded and say, hey, I'm making this film. And if you're comfortable sharing your story, I'd love to have you be part of it. I'd love to talk to you. And the ones that say no, I don't try to talk them into it. And the ones that say yes, you jump on it, you get them to sign the release and you do the interview. And those can be important parts of the project that you're doing. So it's all a challenge, though, because people have lives, they have their own schedule, and your project isn't necessarily the foremost thought on their mind. So you have to work at it and you have to be persistent. Because unless you have a cute angle where they go, oh, what an adorable little guy, I'm going to go do his film. Most people don't trust anybody, you know, especially if you're trying to talk to somebody who's famous or big or well-known. Those people are hard to get. At least I found them difficult. And I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that.
Really? It's interesting to think about that. It takes you a year just to get an interview. It's got to be stressful.
It's very stressful. Especially if there's somebody important, like having the FEMA director in there was huge for the credibility of that film. And it's funny because right before the Brock came out, his PR person came out and looked at me and said, how the hell did you get in here? Because they don't let documentary filmmakers into FEMA. They're usually there to smoke them out, you know, to say, hey, why'd you guys screw up this disaster? Why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? And I said, you know, I told them why. I said, this is how we got in. And they go, all right, cool. So It is very stressful, though. It's probably what I like least about the job. I like the process of making the film, but I don't like all the little bits and pieces. I don't like the fundraising for it. That is a real pain because I'm not a salesman. So if I came to you and said, hey, James, can I get you to contribute $50 towards my film? And you go, nah, I'm not interested. I would go, okay, cool. But somebody who's really a good salesman would go, well, James wants to donate. He just doesn't know it yet. I'm not that way. To me, no is no. It's not maybe.
That's something I think people don't underestimate when you don't have a pre-existing budget or you don't have a backing of a studio or a big production company. It's, you got to wear 15 different hats just to get your film finished and then another 10 different hats to get it actually like properly seen and released.
And you have to be working with people that understand that. You know, if you look at a Hollywood movie, or even a movie like a documentary that has a big budget, you'll see 1,000 people in the credits for that film because everybody has a role. Everybody has something to do. With my films, you may see my name in there 5 times. You may see DP's name in there 3 times. You may see the gaffer in there 2x. I mean, everybody has to do more because you don't have that luxury and you don't have the luxury of failure. There was when we made The Last House Standing, Ron Howard, who I'm a big fan of, made a film about Paradise, California, and the huge wildfire that they had there. And they followed a bunch of families around for a year to see what their lives were like after the fire. Well, if you have his budget, you can afford to follow 10 families, and if five of them are duds, you can still make a pretty good movie. With me, I have to pick one family, and they better be good, because we don't have the money to follow people around that much. You can't afford failures. When I go interview somebody and they suck, I either have to find a way to use them, or that's a loss for us. Whereas with a big company, they can do 100 people and pick the best 10. So you have to be really smart about what you do, or really lucky. Mm-hmm. I like a combination of both.
And so with these two films, License to Burn and Last House Standing, these are timely films, but do you go in, what was the process of even wanting to, you talked a little bit about like why you wanted to make them, but I think for some people, documentary filmmaking is a little detached from them because a regular film, you write the film, you know what the film is going to be going in. The documentary film, and there's so many unknowns. How do you go from this is my concept, this is the finished project?
Well, you have to find something that you're passionate about telling the story. That helps because you're going to take your lumps along the way. So you identify something that you see as an issue or a problem, and then you try to craft, how would I make this come to life to put it on the screen? And then you have to decide, well, what screen am I trying to put it on? You know, if you're, it's very hard to get on Netflix or Amazon Prime. You know, YouTube wants to take documentary films all the time, but they pay nothing to filmmakers, nothing. I mean, it's like for 1,000 minutes of streaming, you might get a nickel. It's almost insulting. So you have to figure out where you want your film to air. That dictates how you shoot it, what camera you use to shoot it, or what cameras. Because if you shoot it on your iPhone, unless you have such a compelling story that Netflix doesn't care because they know they can make so much money with it, you have no chance of getting on if you shoot it with your phone and it's just an average story. It's not the quality that they're looking for. And they have a lot of quality films. So you have to think about all those things. And then you have to think, okay, what do I need to do? How do I tell this story? What's the best way I can tell this story that will have the most impact? And you just have to put the pieces together. You know, that part's always intriguing to me, but I enjoy the process of doing it a lot more than figuring out how to do it. And I always have a lot of ideas for films. I've always been frustrated by the fact that I always link up with partners that are on my level. We're creative people that want to do something. What I needed was a partner who was good at raising money, because that's, to me, the most important part. What's the equalizer, and what ideas get told and what don't? Do you have the money to do it and do it well? And I know a lot of people give advice to filmmakers. I would say the same thing to young filmmakers. Go out and shoot. Go tell your story. But ultimately, you need that money.
Right.
Because you need to make a living. Most people don't understand that. You know, when you have a film, I've had people that call and want to screen the film for free. And they figure just because it's your film and you made it, it's available like Blockbuster. And you could just throw it out there and let millions of people see it. And sure, you want your film seen, but at some point you have to make a living.
Yeah.
You have bills to pay. You have, you know, it wasn't cheap making the film. And so it's tough. I have people that balk sometimes about paying $3.99 to rent my film on my website. Now, if you tell me you really want to see it, but you don't have $3.99, I'll give you a pass to see it. At that point, I don't care. But it'd be nice if people had more regard. I think what we see is all these famous Hollywood people living in $20 million houses and jetting all over the world. And they think all filmmakers are like that. And it's not that way. A lot of us are just paycheck to paycheck trying to do the best we can.
Yeah. And that's what the strikes are for right now, right? That, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but it is about that idea of the artist trying to make a living from
absolutely
labor.
Yeah. I get it. I support them. You know, it's tough, and it's tough when those things go on for so long. For us independent guys, sometimes that's an opportunity.
Yeah.
But you really have to time it right. You know, by the time that all that stuff is settled, my film still won't be ready to go. But, you know, I applaud them trying to get what they think they're worth, because the places that they're working for all make a lot of money. You know, I've worked for places that act like they're so poor us, and they treat the workers terribly, including when they fire you and don't care about your future. So whatever the people can get that are on that on the job every day doing the work, good for them.
And with these films, did you know exactly what you wanted to say with each one? Or are you trying to just, whatever I get is what I get?
I don't like to completely have an idea what I want to say because I want the story to be real. I don't want to dictate the story with my opinion. If you watch a lot of documentaries, I mean, sit down and watch a few docs on Amazon or Netflix or wherever, and you can tell sometimes if a Republican made it, if a Democrat made it, depending on the subject matter, and it's their agenda that they want you to buy into. And you can manipulate film very easily. There was a famous line story that happened years ago with Katie Couric. I don't know if you remember this, where she interviewed a guy from tobacco, big tobacco, I think it was, or guns. It was one of those things. She interviewed this person and they edited in a 7 or 8 second pause after the question that they asked the guy. So what it made, it was a question that any decent human being, I wish I remembered what the subject was, any decent human being would have answered right away. You wouldn't have had to think about it, but they put that in there to make him look like an asshole. Fortunately, he recorded it in real time and he was able to call him out on it and say, that's not what happened. So I don't like to do that. I like to tell the truth in what the story is. So if I set out to make a film about poorly built houses and I find out every house is built great, then the film is about, look, we used to have poorly built houses, but now we have great houses. I'm not going to try to just find crummy houses and say, see, we have a problem. And the same with parenting. There's no parenting problem. It would be great to say that in a film. Hey, parents are doing great. This is perfect. The family bond is intact. It's all good. No, the story is it's not good. It's terrible. But I let other people tell it. It's not George telling you it's terrible. It's the reality of what I'm showing you shows it's terrible.
And these subjects, I don't want to say they're niche, but they're not obvious, right? They're not being discussed like on the front page of a newspaper or on your TV screen or something. What made you the person that you are today that you even wanted to tell these stories?
Because I'm living them. I think I struggle as a parent every day. I don't think of myself up on a pedestal telling you how to parent your children. I say, look, to me, it's a losing battle on a daily basis. And I would love all the help and resources I could get. And I think we all need that. So, you know, that's what compelled me with that, with the last house standing. You know, I've lived in houses all over the place and I've been the victim of horrible construction many times. And I just think people need to open their eyes and wake up. It's frustrating to me, the bad decisions that we all make. And the reality is they all cost society. They don't just cost you. If you have a crummy house and that house burns down in a disaster and the whole neighborhood burns down, everybody's insurance is going to feel the ripple of that. We all pay for other people's mistakes. That's the way the insurance industry works. They spread the risk around. You know, I have a 16-year-old son who drives a car. My insurance went through the roof.
Yeah,
I didn't do anything wrong. He's not a bad kid. He's got a decent grade point average. But that category of driver is horrendous.
Yeah.
And so it ruins it for everybody. So that's the way I feel about the causes that I choose. And it just motivated me to want to tell that story because of the experiences I have with it. It's like, you know, I wish I didn't have to tell you not to put your hand on the stove because it was on.
Right.
I wish you would look at it and go, that's a bad idea. But if you see one person get burned and then another person and then another person, yeah, you're going to go, I'm not going to do that.
It was funny because when I was listening to your interviews that you've done, it seemed a little removed from me. Like, oh, like, you know, they're talking about the wood versus the concrete versus the nails versus the brackets. But I remember you said in one of your interviews that was recorded like 2 years ago, that, for example, Tampa Bay was going to have big problems when the next hurricane came. And then last year, they just had a big hurricane that did so much damage. I mean, that's kind of what you're getting at, obviously.
It's something that everybody needs to be concerned about, even if you don't think you live in an area that can have that kind of problem. In Florida, everybody has that problem. Here in Tampa, we're just lucky. Storms, since I've lived here, I think we've had 5 that if they had hit the right way or the wrong way, we would have been decimated as a community. And each one missed. And I was comparing this to somebody the other day. I mean, you're probably too young for this. Did you ever see the movie The Deer Hunter?
Yes.
Remember Christopher Walken's character where he's playing Russian roulette?
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, the game where you put a bullet in, you spin the barrel and you fire the gun.
Yeah.
You shoot the gun. And to me, that's what it felt like with each hurricane that went by. It's like Russian roulette. You know, there's a good chance it'll miss us. We have a chance it'll miss us. But what if it's that bullseye and then it's over? And that's the fear in that. And I think most people just don't think it's going to happen to them. You know, if you own a house, you're probably not thinking that it's going to burn down. So you have bushes right against your house. Your attic isn't ventilated properly. Your roof is an old shingle roof that's just waiting for a spark to light it on fire. People just don't think those things through. And then you have a two-story house. You don't have a plan to get out. You don't have a plan for how your family would evacuate if you had to go. Most people don't think of any of that. Most people don't have generators. Most of my neighbors don't have generators. When the power goes out here, you know the people that do because you can hear them a block or two away. And it's like, why would you not have one? Even if I never have to use it, the one time I do, it'll have been worth it because we won't be miserable.
Yeah, I think, and I live in New York, so we had like Ida and Sandy back to back years, and we had like terrible flooding. And everyone now is more aware of it because of those storms. But why do you think that's the case? Because you would think it's pretty simple. I have a house, it should be protected, but then you have these storms. The storms always happen in Texas and the Gulf Coast and Florida. And I mean, every area has something, right?
Yeah, every area has its hazards. And the ones that don't might not be places you actually want to live. I'm not going to name any places because I think, I've lived a lot of places that are fantastic. But the idea is you buy that house and you're either drawn to it because it's near a school where your kids can go. It has a nice backyard where they can play. It's near stores you can walk to. And you think of all the things that will make your life better. But the most important thing you should really be thinking about is how is this house built? And when the real estate market's really competitive, people are afraid to ask too many questions. Gosh, if I ask them all these questions, they're going to throw me out. They're not going to sell me the house. And you're almost trying to suck up to them and act like you like it, as opposed to asking them questions to find out why it's going to be a horrible home for you to buy. You know, there's a great example here in Florida. With all the hurricanes we have and all the flooding and water, they finally put in that there's a disclosure form that the seller or the realtor can fill out to say whether or not the house is flooded before. But here's the catch for them. They don't have to present it to you unless you ask. It's not required. So I could be looking at your house to buy it. 6 months ago, you could have been under 10 feet of water. You fixed it. And you don't have to tell me. That's insane. Now, I don't know how long it'll take to change that. But that's why I tell people you can change it right now. Anytime you're buying a house, ask a bunch of questions. Has this house ever flooded before? What did you consider in terms of hazards when you were building it that it could survive? Did you build this house to code? Which what happens when the code changes a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now? Or did you think forward and go, I want to build this better than code so it'll actually be around? I mean, I would love to be getting second cracks at all the homes I've ever lived in and ask those questions. I wouldn't have bought any of them. And I think people need to wake up. Have you seen the movie The World According to Garp?
No.
There's a great scene in there where Robin Williams and his wife are looking at a house with a realtor and an airplane crashes into the house and there's a mess everywhere. And his wife looks at him and he goes, honey, we'll take the house. And she goes, what? Are you kidding? And he goes, do you realize the odds of a plane ever hitting this house again? And to him, that house has been pre-disastered. Well, in my film, The Last House Standing, we went to Moore, Oklahoma, where they had 8 major tornadoes affect the town. 8.
Wow.
It took 8 for them to change the building code and build the houses better. And I used that clip right before that. The odds of it ever happening again. Well, here it happened again and again and again. You know, they say lightning never strikes in the same place twice. But if it's anywhere close, it's going to affect you. You know, just because it's happened once. Statistics don't mean that it's never going to happen again. Right. And people need to know that.
Covering these events, what did you, from the documentaries that you've made, both This Last House Standing and these issues, but even to a lesser extent, Licensed to Parent, and even with like your news career, how does that affect your thinking about the world and issues that are discussed?
In what way? That's a pretty broad question.
Well, I just mean in the sense, if you're doing all this extensive research that other people may not be doing on the subjects, like how does that affect how you now view these issues or view, like, especially when you're talking to people so candidly, you're meeting a lot of people who was affected personally.
It makes me realize we're on our own. It makes me realize that you can't count on other people. Okay, there's people you can count on, first responders, people, law officials. There's some people, policemen, you can count on some people when you need them as the accidents happen or the disaster right afterwards. But in terms of establishing whether you're in a safe place and you're going to be okay and you're making a good investment, nobody's looking out for you. Nobody cares about you more than you do. So you need to be your biggest advocate. If you're not looking out for yourself, you have no chance. And that's what I encourage people to do, is open your eyes and be your own best advocate. And so it's kind of made me skeptical of anything. I don't necessarily believe anything politicians tell us, government officials, scientists. I'm skeptical of everything because I think if you look behind a lot of these people, there's a rich politician who got into office as a public servant and now has made a fortune. What are they? They're not public servants. They're there to make money. They're there for themselves. And I think that's the case about a lot of people, you know, and so it's just made me ask a lot more questions and not take things at face value.
One other thing that I was doing when I was listening to your podcast was that you were at the 89 World Series during the earthquake. I think that explains a lot.
I was on the top deck of Candlestick Park and everybody was stomping their feet as the rumble to get going. They were excited that the game was going, but then the rumble got louder and then the glass started shaking and the stadium started swaying. I thought we were going to get killed right there. And the hotel we were staying in, there was a water tower on top that collapsed. So the whole hotel pancaked. So the fire department gave us a minute to run in and grab our luggage afterwards. And that hotel ended up having to be torn down. The Bay Bridge was destroyed when I worked there and lived there. I used to drive that route every day to work. That pancaked. The neighborhood I lived in the Marina District in San Francisco, a lot of those places were declared unlivable and were roped off. But yeah, I was at that game and it was an experience I have never forgotten. It was scary.
Yeah, it's got to be a life-changing. I mean, because a lot of people could say they've either lived through the earthquake or lived through a natural disaster or like been to it. But like to have all of that come together in one moment has to be a lot to digest.
It is. It's very scary to think what could have happened if that stadium had collapsed. I mean, you have 45 or 50,000 people right there, and it sure felt like it was going to. Candlestick Park, did you see The Rock's movie, San Andreas?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
that's what it kind of, I mean, it wasn't anywhere as bad as that.
Right.
But a lot of things did collapse and break there. A lot of things could get destroyed. And a guy that was in my film, The Last House Standing, said if there was a major earthquake in California, 60% of the buildings would be uninhabitable. 60%. It's hard to wrap your head around that number.
Right.
It's scary.
It's honestly interesting too, because I feel like, you know, you also talked about some negative experiences that you've had. You've kind of had a life path that brought you to this. So you're more cognizant about it, like these experiences that you've had, but many people have never thought about it. But it's interesting because it's bound to happen. And when it does, it's going to, you know, have those drastically negative impacts on everybody.
Absolutely. And, you know, you look at horrible things that happen in the world and you think about the impacts that it has on those people, you know, mine pale in comparison to a lot of things that are going on, but they're still day-to-day things that when you don't think of them, make your life a lot more difficult. It's like life is difficult enough on a daily basis. So anything can happen. I give this speech when I speak at events, the difference between timing and luck and whether or not you can rely on those things. And sometimes you have horrible timing, sometimes you have terrible luck. But if you're prepared and you know a lot of things or you've done the work beforehand, you can deal with bad luck better. You can deal with having poor timing because you're prepared. At least you have a backup plan. You know, you can't stop that drunk driver from ramming into your car. Hopefully you had your seatbelt on. Hopefully you had a safe vehicle. I mean, there's usually something you could have done. Sometimes there's nothing. if plane crashes, you can't do anything. But there's, in a lot of instances, your fate would be different if you had been more prepared.
So what films now? You said you have some projects coming up. What's next for you?
Well, there's one film I'm making that it's a little in the same vein of Licensed to Parent. It's called American Dysfunction, A Picture is an Illusion. And it's about the failing family structure in this country and how 96% of families, I saw a statistic, 96% of families are dysfunctional. And why is this important?
Wow.
That core value of family instills so many things in people. Without that, you have people that are kind of on their own trying to figure it out. And it's not good for society. It's not good for the country. And I try to show in this film that there are ways to change that trajectory. There's signs you can use to save your family. There's things that come up on a day-to-day basis that if you just handled them differently, maybe you could hold that family unit together better. And we have a business plan for that film. I'm trying to raise the money. It's the first time I've done that where we're looking for investors in the film. And because it's a low budget film, it'll be easier for investors to make money if we're successful. You know, you invest in a Hollywood movie with a $80 million budget, they got to make a lot of money before you're going to see any money.
Right.
With my film, if we sell it to Netflix or Amazon, people could double their money potentially.
Right. Not so have to worry about anything else.
Yeah. So there's a path to actually making money. You still have to sign a disclosure saying, I realize films are highly risky and I'll probably lose everything because that's just the nature of the film business.
Right.
But that film's going to be good. And so I'm trying to raise money for that. And then the second film we're starting production on next month is called Built to Last, Buyer Beware. And we're going to shoot that here in Florida. And that's about how it's kind of like The Last House Standing. It's like we don't really understand the house we're buying and what went into making that house a piece of crap. Why is the building code not stronger? Why are our officials not making it better? And we're going to travel around Florida and show people, this is what happens when you do it poorly, and this is what happens when you do it well. It's like, we know how to build better houses. Why aren't we? Why aren't we demanding that? So we're starting that one in December, and we've raised most of the money on that. I'm actually going to do a fundraiser to try to raise the remaining budget for that. But those are the two projects I'm working on now.
Yeah, I want to say this on the podcast. I'm glad that makes you think a little bit more about what's going on when you think about the fact that a lot of these houses are not. I think when a lot of people see a house, you know, hurricane or tornado, they just think, oh, well, of course the houses are destroyed, right? Because it's supposed to be a hurricane or tornado. But maybe if the houses were better, that wouldn't be the case. You know what I'm saying? Like unnecessary bad outcomes just because of our expectations or perceptions of such. It's very interesting.
Absolutely.
Actually. I think it's an important message.
And you saw that in Mexico Beach in The Last House Standing. Okay, the people that we featured in the film, The Last House Standing, the gentleman who owned that house, they built that house to survive a Category 5 hurricane with storm surge. That's what they intended to do, and it worked. All the stuff around them was old construction that was built years ago, different building codes, different goal. A lot of them were slab on grade, so that's the worst kind of house you can have in a flood. You know, you can have a brand new house, but if it's getting storm surge, you're probably not going to survive, or it's going to be pretty, pretty badly damaged. So, you know, the idea is you really have to take a look at these things and see, you know, if you don't think about it, you have no chance.
Right.
If you don't, and it just doesn't take a lot to ask more questions. It doesn't take a lot to ask what's behind the walls. They might not always tell you, but a good inspection can at least reveal vulnerabilities, and you can understand, am I buying a house in a neighborhood that this could happen or that could happen? Did you walk around and talk to neighbors? Do you know what the historic, we looked at one house when we moved here to Tampa, and our realtor took it, it was under construction, and a guy walked by and I said, hey, what can you tell me about this neighborhood? He goes, I wouldn't buy that house. He goes, every time it rains, the water comes up to the front door.
Wow.
We were like the coyote. We were like the roadrunner. You know, we were out of there. He's like, okay, we're done with this one. And that's what people need to do. Ask questions. If we just walked up to it without that, it looked like a cured house.
Right. Yeah,
you would have no idea. And so you got to take the time. You have to do the work and ask the questions, even if it means you don't find something right away. You're better off doing that than finding something crappy.
And I got to say, that's a good message for anything in life. It's always better to ask questions and know what you're getting yourself into instead of just hoping that it's going to be the best outcome.
That's what they used to tell us when I started in the news business, that like when you go to a news conference, there's no such thing as a bad, stupid question, just bad answers. So, you know, you'll hear some questions where you just want to pull your hair out, but at least they asked.
Yeah.
The person that you're asking doesn't have to answer. And sometimes when they don't answer, that tells you more than if they did answer.
Yeah. So you give a lot of advice for home owning, a little bit of advice for parenting. As we wind down the interview here, you have any advice for filmmakers, even if they're trying to be in documentary film, even if they're not, as they get into this business? Because a lot of people that I listen are younger people that work in film.
There's so many resources. I always go crazy when my kids come up to and ask me a question, because I say, do you realize that phone that you're tethered to has every answer imaginable that you can find out yourself in 2 seconds? You know, so there's so many resources to learn about filmmaking. There's so many films you could watch and understand what they were doing. There's so many resources for editing films and getting equipment and all these. There's so many ways you could creatively do these things. You just have to want to do it. And so what I would encourage them is, don't be one of those people that sits there and goes, I had some great ideas, but I just couldn't do anything with it. Be somebody that said, I have a great idea and I'm going to do something with it. And then don't take no for an answer. You know, young people today, they look at older people. They look at me. I see it from my kids every day. They just roll their eyes like, I don't know what I'm talking about. That's the reality is we know something. We made it to this point. And if you could learn and not have to have the pains or the mistakes that we had to go through, why wouldn't you? Technology is now with AI. You could write an outline for a script. There's so many things you can do more easily now. Granted, there's more distractions, so you have an excuse. Well, I was playing this video game. Oh, I had to spend time with my Xbox. I mean, I've heard them all. But if you really are passionate about something, there's no lack of resources to learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have anything else you would like to? I always let the guests with the final question kind of just go wherever they want. They want to talk about something they wanted to talk about that didn't ask, or anything that they not even relevant. Doesn't really matter to me. The floor is yours. Carte blanche.
I would just plug my own stuff, man. I would just say that I would hope that people, especially if you have a much younger audience, I would like them to just check out my podcast, Homeowners Be Aware, because I think if they're ever thinking of buying a house, there's things you can learn. And it's not aimed at senior citizens buying houses. It's aimed at anybody buying houses. And you, at a young age, you don't want the setback. They say when you buy a house and it gets destroyed, that can set people back 5 or 10 years in their life. And some people never recover from it. Because your house gets destroyed, the mortgage company doesn't care. If you weren't insured properly and you still owe them money, they want their money. You're paying that money back one way or the other. So no, you know, I would say you can pick up a lot of information. Homeownersbeaware.com is my website. Go check it out. And then if you want to see the different projects I'm working on, movetheworldfilms.org is my film company. And if there's contact forms on both of those resources, if you have questions, if you have a story for the first house that you bought that you want to share, I'd love to get guests on my podcast that talk about their home nightmare or their home great experience. I love to have a story where somebody says, yeah, I moved in, we found this, this, and this in the inspection, and we're having the greatest experience with this house. There are less of those, but I would love to hear them. So if anybody has a story like that, I'd love for you to share it with me.
Phenomenal. Well, George, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. Really appreciate it. And I hope to, I watched a little bit of your films, but I'm trying to finish those. And I definitely wish you all the best with these two additional films you have upcoming.
Thank you so much for giving me the time today. I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Well, everybody, that's it for this episode. We'll be back most likely in a couple weeks, as I will be on some films. In the next couple weeks, I will be able to record a podcast, but we'll have another interview I'm working on with another director. So As always, guys, thanks so much for listening. This was Rumors, Money, and Movies. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.